Coming to you from my apartment that doubles as a podcast recording studio. This is What Should I Do With My Life with Steph Horowitz. I'm Steph Horowitz. Thanks for joining me. This podcast is about how none of us know what we're doing. None of us have it figured out. No matter if you seem like you have it all together, you really don't, so be honest. We're going to talk about real stories from real people, their experiences, how they're figuring it out. From career pivots to being in the same industry for 40 years, we're going to hash this thing out so we can all find more meaning and passion in our work and day-to-days. Hi, all. Today we have Tyler Hall on the pod. Tyler is a successful founder. He's a CEO, a tech leader, an investor, an advisor, also a motorcycle enthusiast, a dad, and a husband. Tyler is a serial entrepreneur who has founded several companies, one of them being recently acquired automotive tech company Drivably. Today, he works closely with early-stage tech CEOs to help them achieve the balance between personal well-being and business success through various coaching offerings and unique services for founders. Tyler shares the life-changing moment that made him reevaluate his career path. He shares how we can all operate in our zone of genius and talks about what exactly you need to write down with a pen and paper when you're trying to figure out what to do with your life. There's so much more we could have gotten into. This is really the tippy top of the iceberg, but I had a great time, great conversation. Maybe one day Tyler will be coaching me. Meet him. Here's Tyler Hall. I already feel like, damn, we didn't cover it all. We didn't even start. Like, I just could tell with the topics and what I want to talk to you about that we're going to have to do probably another chat, but whatever. I won't set us off on that note, but I'm very happy to have you joining me on the show today.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I feel like we should just dive in. Do you also feel that way?
I've felt that way since the day I was born.
Oh my God. Well, that is a big statement and very fitting for basically everything you've done in your life, which we will be talking about today. So then, yes, Tyler, we're diving in. Let's just get the ball rolling in one sentence. Can you please share what it is that you do?
Yeah, I advise and coach early stage technology companies.
So concise the way, how long did you work on perfecting that one-liner?
I practiced it 17 times in the mirror this morning.
I love it.
For this podcast.
Well, everyone listening soon is going to find out that Tyler has a lot of crazy, interesting experiences under his belt. So I'm very impressed that he just could really wrap it up in a bow nicely, but we're going to unwrap it right now. That's what we're doing. So I really want to start off with you, Tyler. You know, we did a little chemistry call a few weeks ago, got to know each other based on meeting you and your work. Cars play a really big theme. Automotives, the automotive industry, cars. And I'm thinking, did this guy like want to be a race car driver when he grew up? So I'm just curious, where did your love for cars begin? Did you know your career would have so many touch points with cars?
0%. It's actually pretty simple how this all happened. I was going to school in college in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I was working for the largest news and media company in Utah at the time, full-time, while a full-time student. People in Utah at the time, and even today, if they're going to sell their car, they don't use Facebook or eBay or Craigslist or otherwise. They typically use KSL.com, which is where I worked. So saved up enough money, college student, to buy my first car. I bought that car. I realized I got a great deal. And so I listed it on our classifieds and I sold it and I made $1,000. And that ended up becoming the sort of catalyst moment to take me to buying and selling about 200 cars over the next 2 years. So, you know, I actually didn't love cars at all. Wasn't into race cars growing up or any of these sort of things. Was more into motorcycles. And that was a moment that changed everything. I took a little bit of a break, as we'll probably talk about, from the automotive industry, but now I'm back and I think mostly stuck. So it's great.
it's a transforming industry, as we know. So there's a lot of, wiggle room. I love that there's this definitive moment. And I always say on the show, I try to normalize the fact that most people don't have a definitive moment, but I love to hear it. And I'm curious from you. You made that first sale. You're a college kid. You just sold a car. You made $1,000. Like, how did you feel? What are you thinking?
I felt like the richest man on the earth when I made that first $1,000, because to make $1,000 in my day job took like a month, right? And this took like 3 days. And so the next one I made 2,000. And that was like, I mean, it was 100% more than I made on the first. It was amazing. And eventually I realized that I could make about $1,000 every time I sold a car. And I could do this like on average twice a week, and then did that for like 2 years, right? So I went from being like, where's my next cup of ramen noodles, to like full-on drug dealer with, a few $100,000 of cash, and hopefully the IRS isn't listening, and hopefully it was long enough ago that, that won't be an issue.
This is crazy. I'm thinking a few things when you tell me this. First of all, I'm thinking with cars and especially buying used cars, there's a lot of, people talk about lemons. I don't know anything about cars. I don't own a car. I never had a car. I, used a family car in high school and college, but how did you get people to trust you? A college kid, who does he think he is? Like, can we trust him? And then on that note, so curious what you were like. I mean, it sounds like you were super confident. You thought you could do anything, which, as we know, are ingredients needed for someone to be an entrepreneur, which is what you are.
I had developed a bit of a talk track around the idea that I was a poor college student from the very beginning. And so, like, I would get people emotionally attached to me by saying, like, look, I can't afford to pay you what you're asking for your car. You should sell it to me for a lot less money. And people, I think, would like empathize with that. Now, the problem was I didn't change my script even after buying and selling 50 or 100 cars. Right. So was that like the most honest thing to for me to say? Probably not. But like, it's just what I did. I was still a college student. I still, in my mind, was poor. And I think that just maintaining that talk track was really what helped me buy cars for less than they were worth, and then ultimately mark them up and make money. By the
That's,
way, this came back to haunt me a few times, and I'm happy to share like one specific story where that happened.
bring it on.
I bought a car from a guy. I don't know that I've ever shared this. This is fun. I bought a car from a guy. Nice guy. Very, very nice kind of old guy. And the vehicle that I bought was a Jeep Wrangler. Okay. And I had gotten so good at buying vehicles and selling them that I bought this Jeep for one purpose, and it was to use it to go on a date that night, a double date with now who is my wife and a good friend of mine and his future wife. And we jumped in this Jeep and we drove up to the mountains and we had a fire and it was amazing. And I drove down and I washed it and I listed it and I sold it. The problem was when I listed it the next day, this guy saw the listing. Okay, I bought this Jeep for $3,000. I listed it for $5,000. Okay, he saw the listing and he sent me a message and basically said, like, you're going to hell. Because you sold me on the fact that you were this poor college kid and this was your dream Jeep and all these things. And I just saw my Jeep. It's listed for $5,000. Like, you're a terrible person. And like, that really hurt me. I was like, wow, maybe I am a terrible person for like doing this. So I think after that, like, I changed my tune a bit and it was a good learning lesson. I actually felt really bad. I told the guy, like, I'll sell you your Jeep back for what I paid for it. Like, I'm sorry. We did it for the date and we got our date and it was great. So I didn't really need it anymore anyways.
Date. Oh my God, that's a crazy story. You have this new podcast, the Roller Coaster Podcast, and we're going to talk more about that later, but I know you interviewed your brother. I listened, and He's also an entrepreneur and an investor. And like, what's in the water at your house? What's with this entrepreneurial spirit? It's starting at a young age. Where did it begin?
It's funny, I think most entrepreneurs that have multiple in their family siblings, right? It's fairly typical that their parents were entrepreneurs. Their father or their mother did something, they ran a business, they had startups. It wasn't the case in our house. Our parents were actually a bit more traditional, provided a great lifestyle for us growing up, but pretty risk averse, pretty traditional. And so really for me, I got into being an entrepreneur, I think because my older brother Derek, like he set the stage. He's 5 years older than me. You know, at a young age, he served a mission for our church when he was 19, went to Brazil on his mission for 2 years. He came home, he realized like that the US was so far advanced in so many areas, and he thought, there's opportunities to take what we've done in the US down to Brazil. So he moved to Brazil when he was like 25, I think, or maybe even
Wow.
24. I think he's been there now almost 15 years. And he's just started building businesses that were working in the US, but that hadn't yet come to Brazil. And he's found a ton of success doing that. And so, you know, I think his example really motivated me and encouraged me to want to be an entrepreneur. But our other siblings, we have three others, like they want almost nothing to do with entrepreneurship. One of them's really into music. Another one's also like sort of a creative, and the other one's a barber, and that's what they love, and that's what they do, and we love them the same. But yeah, me and Derek, my oldest brother, are cut from a bit different cloth. So.
And it's really nice that you both have that you can support each other. I mean, do you feel like you advise him, he advises you? Do you talk business a lot? Do you go to each
Oh
other?
man. Yeah, that's a good question. It hasn't always been that way, Steph. So we were quite competitive, to the point of like, I would say up until maybe 2 years ago, we were like enemies, right? So we loved each other as siblings, but we weren't really rooting for each other. And I think it was because we had these egos that said like, no, I'm going to be more successful than him, right? We were always competitive growing up in sports and otherwise. And once we realized like, what the hell are we doing? Like, we need to support each other. We need to have each other's backs. And I think we both sort of went through some life-changing events, and therapy and other things helped us realize like, we should be on the same team here. And so the last 2 years, I think we've gone from complete sort of enemies to like, he's my best friend. We talk almost every day. I would say like, I coach him in his business professionally. He coaches me and mentors me the same in return. And things work a lot better that way. I wish we would have figured this out earlier.
Thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate that honesty. And I think that's just real, you know, like we can't sit here and have this conversation. Yeah, we were always helping each other and this, that, whatever, and
No.
shooting ideas off each other. Most of the time, it doesn't happen that way. Tyler, I'm really excited just to get into so much of the stuff you're working on and your approaches. And first, I feel like I need to set the scene a little with you because you are a serial entrepreneur. You've created several companies. So I don't know if this is crazy to do some kind of little timeline just to set the stage of your journey leading up a bit to where we are now.
This I think becomes a bit shocking to some people because I think a lot of people think I'm a lot older than I am. And so I leave college, okay, I drop out of college at 21. I go join an early stage startup called Domo. Domo was CEO of Domo was a guy named Josh James, who's a one of the greatest entrepreneurs of all time. He started a company called Omniture. It was acquired by Adobe for $1.8 billion.
Nice.
Starts another company called Domo. My brother and him are friends. My brother introduces me. I sit down with Josh. I say, Josh, I'll do whatever you want me to do. Okay. This is after I'd flipped all these cars and, you know, start working at Domo, realize that school is not my thing. Realize like I'm going to be an entrepreneur, I'm going to build companies, and this traditional way of learning does not resonate well with me. So I drop out of school. I'm at Domo for 3 years. The 3 years I'm there, we raise $900 million of venture capital. We grow the staff from 30 people to 900 people.
Oh my
One of the fastest
gosh.
growing SaaS businesses ever in history. And I learn a ton. And I do this because I know one day I want to start my own business. So even though I'm just in sort of entry-level sales roles at Domo, I sit in as many product meetings as they'll let me. You know, I get really curious. I sit with the operations team. I learn a lot about just how the business operates. I leave Domo 3 years later. I go to a company called HireVue that was backed by Sequoia, had raised about 100 million. At this point, I'm 25. I have this big role. I'm sort of leading the global renewals business, about a $50 million a year business by the time I left. That company, we Domo IPOs, HireVue, we go on to sell for $500 million to a private equity group. Those two experiences, I think, were the experiences that I needed to understand, like, truly what was required to go build an enterprise software company. At least I thought I knew, right? And then 2018, in between there, I had launched. Been an investor in a few companies. I had launched a couple of like sort of failed startups, launched a cryotherapy business, started a fund at some point. But 2018, I launched AutoHaul, which is a car dealership. And I do this because I want to incubate and sort of test a few theses that I had about the automotive industry from things I learned in college. We do that for 1 year. We incubate a couple of different products, very expensive R&D project, but now we knew exactly what it was like to be our customer, which was the car dealer. January 2019, we spin Drivably out. We raise a few million dollars of venture capital backed by investors like Porsche, first company in North America backed by Porsche. Feel very fortunate to have some good fortune and good luck in the fundraising process. Yeah, from there, like, you know, what we can sort of dive into the story, but that's the timeline of things that happen.
You were so tuned in to yourself that you took the risk to drop out of college. You said, oh, this is a traditional route. This is what's expected of me. This is what people around me are doing, expect me to do. And you felt in your gut, that's not what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to do this. I'm supposed to do that. I'm supposed to start something. I think it is very brave. I feel just obviously, to be an entrepreneur and you, as someone who started many different companies, are very brave. You're a risk taker and you're also very in tune with yourself. And you also have to be able to not care what everyone's gonna think of you because startups fail. Most of them fail. You know, we take risks, and part of taking risks is that we could fail. So, like, how the heck did you get so in tune with yourself? I mean, a lot of people feel that way, like, oh, I don't actually want to do this. And I don't, you know, this, I feel misaligned, but people are too scared to take the step. And that could be with starting a business, that could be with many decisions. Like, do you have any advice on how to take that step?
First of all, like, and we can get back to this. I want to be very clear. I did give a shit what people thought about me for a long time. Maybe the best thing I've ever learned in my life is to stop caring so much what people think. Okay, so we can talk more about this, but to answer your question directly, I've thought about this a lot. And I think what happened was when I was younger, I was overweight, like wildly overweight. Okay. But I had figured out that being a fat kid was not an issue because I was also the funniest kid. Okay. So I was like, I was the class clown and I was also the most athletic, like sort of giftedly athletic kid, but I was chubby. And so it never impacted me. I realized that I think through that experience, like, I mean, people made fun of my weight, but it didn't matter because I had these other things going for me. So I realized that, like, no matter what your crutch is in life, there's going to be other things that can like offset that. And so I had that from a young age. And I think I realized at some point, I realized like I was in tune enough with my skills and my capabilities, one of them being able to tell a story being good at sales. Like once I realized, like being a good negotiator, once I realized I had a few skills that I was uniquely qualified at, it gave me the confidence I needed to be like, okay, like with these skills, I can go on to build companies. I can go on to, now coach CEOs and advise companies and invest and do these sort of things. But yeah, it's hard to pinpoint, like outside of that experience I had as a child, where that came from.
Well, I think what you said, like you need to do, by you, I mean everyone, all of us and people listening, we have to do some kind of inventory to look at our skills and what we have and what's our situation and what do I have that I can use to take me to that place, to get me out of here to do what I feel like I should be doing. Last time we chatted, you brought up something very personal to me, a moment in your private life, in your personal life that happened that made you realize it was time for a big change and it ultimately shifted your career trajectory, outlook on a lot of things. So if you're comfortable, would love to hear your story.
I think there's a precursor to the story that's really interesting that I haven't shared yet before. We go through Drivably. We have our ups and downs, mostly downs, by the way. Like we did everything wrong you could genuinely. Like I was a horrible CEO for like the first year or so. A lot of learnings, a lot of hard mistakes. Eventually, we have some good fortune, some good timing. COVID happens, gives us tailwinds. Company takes off. Does amazing for the next year. We have five or six companies that want to acquire the business. We run a process, and ultimately we're acquired October of 2021. 2 months later, it's probably December of 21. I'm in Houston, Texas, and I'm there on business. I'm meeting with customers. I'm meeting with a few of our field salespeople, and I get to my hotel, and I step on the elevator. And the doors were about to close, and a guy sticks his arm in, opens the door, hops on the elevator with me. I'm actually relatively like reserved in public. I don't sort of go out of my way to talk to people, hardly at all. I tend to keep to myself a bit more. But in this case, I felt prompted to just ask this guy how he was doing. And I just simply said, "Hey man, how you doing?" And he said, "I'm not doing very well. I just buried my 26-year-old son today." And I just like, I was like, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know how to respond. And so I just listened. And he said he wasn't a drug addict. He was an amazing kid. It was a total accident. And it came out of nowhere. It came out of left field. And again, I didn't know what to do. We got to his floor, the doors open. And I just held my arms out to hug this guy. I said, "I'm so sorry to hear that." I like speechless, right? And he looks me in the face and he says, "Just really hold those that you love the most close to you because you never know when it's going to be their last day." And I remember like the doors close and literally I just burst into tears. I'm like, did that actually just happen? And I went back to my hotel room. And I pulled out my phone and I recorded myself talking about this experience. I still have this video. And then the next thing I did was I called my wife and I said, "Hey, I just had this experience. It was very powerful." And we're both like crying on the phone, like, "Oh my gosh, how terrible would that be?" Okay. 3 months later, I'm in New York City on business again. And we're getting ready to present at NASDAQ. This is a big investor day. It's a big moment in my career. And I wake up that morning from a call from my mother-in-law. And immediately I felt pretty uneasy because I love my mother-in-law, but we don't talk on the phone ever, let alone at 5 a.m. Arizona time, right? So I reluctantly answer the phone and she says, "Hey, I know you're in business, but I had to call you. Brooklyn, who's her daughter, my wife, is being rushed to the hospital in an ambulance." And I said, "What's going on?" And she said, "We don't know, but you should probably get home as soon as possible." So I send a text to my assistant. I say, "Hey, I can't be at the investor day. I got to get home. I don't something's happened to my wife." So she books me a car, books a flight. And if you've ever been to New York City, right, you'll understand that getting out of the city's not super easy. And so, like, when really bad things like this happen in life, they tend to just get better, right? Like, you tend to like sort of hit a low point and then things just will progress. And right, like, I had this hope that it's going to be fine. Maybe she was lightheaded. Maybe she forgot to eat food or drink. She was pregnant at the time. So I knew that some of that could be off. And in this case, it was actually the opposite. Things weren't like getting better. The text updates I was getting from her father, who was the only one that was allowed to be in the hospital, were progressively getting worse. And so the thread of messages were just arrived at the hospital. She's not doing well. She's having a hard time maintaining consciousness. And then the next one is they just did an ultrasound. They found blood in her abdomen. She's been bleeding out internally. The next one was, I'm standing at the airport. I actually have my right arm on top of an ATM machine to like balance myself because I was starting to feel lightheaded. And it was a picture of what the doctor had written on the whiteboard, which said ruptured ectopic pregnancy. And so the first thing I do is I go to Google and I Google this and I realize that in many cases, with high probability, this leads to death. And I thought, I mean, my whole world, everything started spinning. Like, I literally almost physically passed out. I felt sick. Obviously, it was very emotional. And I get on the plane, and the next message is they've rushed her in for an emergency surgery. The next message is she's still in surgery, still in surgery, still in surgery. This went on for 3 hours. And, we've delivered three babies at this point. And so the delivery process of delivering a child is like 10 minutes. Like, once they're ready to go, it's really quick. And so the fact that she was in there for multiple hours made me very concerned. And the last message I got, which was now 5 hours later, basically, as the plane is getting ready to land, was some version of brace yourself. It's not looking good, right? And so at this point, I'm convinced that I'm going to lose my wife. And I had to sort of have every thought you could have at that point as a father, which was like, how am I going to raise these kids? What am I going to do? Am I ever going to love somebody the way that I've loved her? Have I been a good father? Have I been a good husband? I'm sort of psychoanalyzing my relationships. Like, life flashes before your eyes, right? You have sort of every thought in that moment. And this was extremely difficult to go through in a process. And so I land, I'm sprinting to my Uber. I get to the Uber, we get in the car, tell the Uber driver, drive as fast as you can to get to the hospital. We get there. I basically run right past the entrance through the emergency room. Get up to her room. She's still, when I say hanging on by a thread, I mean like barely hanging on. And we have this experience when I walk in and I ask her father, I say, how's she doing? And she sort of came to life in a quite scary way. She had kind of this reaction to hearing my voice. I didn't realize what was going on. We had to call the doctors in and they had to like calm her down, and it was really scary. He said she hasn't done that before. She hasn't even moved since she's been in here. Later, she told me that when she heard my voice, she couldn't control her emotions. And it was So we went through about 5 days of that, where every night I went to sleep and just hoped that she was going to make it through the night. And through a lot of miracles, and I think a lot of prayers and other things, she made it through, and today is very healthy. But that experience, those 5 days in the hospital, and then another 30 days of touch and go at home, was life-changing, right? So I spent every night deeply reflecting, committing to making changes, committing to being sort of a better father, better husband, committing to having more meaningful relationships, committing to myself to find fulfillment and purpose in my life. And without going through that experience, I don't know that I would have gotten here. I think I would have still been stuck in my old ways. So.
Thank you for sharing that. So thankful that your wife is okay and just can't believe you had to go through that and she went through that in the family and it's unimaginable stress. I mean, all of it. It's really, there's no words for it. And I feel like, right, how could it not make you or anyone who goes through a moment like that where their world could just flip upside down, not take an inventory for a second and check in on what's going on, what's really important, what do I want to be doing, who do I want to be, what happened in terms of your career after this big life-changing moment, what steps did you take to make a change, and what did that look like?
I was still at the parent company at this time. I realized that before I realized what was going to make me fulfilled, I realized the things that weren't going to make me fulfilled. And one of those things was staying at the parent company. Not because I didn't love these people or the company or the opportunity. I just knew that this wasn't it, right? This wasn't what my life should be. And so I basically ripped the Band-Aid off, if you will. I called our CEO. I said, "Hey, I've got to go. I've got to leave." And I think it was shocking to him and to the whole company, but I think they were empathetic and understood where I was coming from. I left the company. I played sort of full-time dad for a few months. At the same time, I was advising a venture capital fund, and I was really enjoying the work that I was doing with them, spending a lot of time with founders and companies. And as I got more and more ingrained in that, I realized, like, this is my thing. This is the thing that I love to do. This is bringing me, like, the ultimate sense of purpose and fulfillment, helping other founders that were in my shoes that I was just barely in, like, navigate this impossible roller coaster ride. And so around that same time, one of the founders that I was an advisor to said, "Hey, my board's asked me to get a coach." And I said, "Cool." And he said, "And I want you to be my coach." And I said, "It's not really what I do, right? Like, there's professional CEO coaches out there that are amazing. Like, let me make some intros." And this individual persisted, said, "Nope, it's like, I feel really strongly that it's you." And so I spent some time, like, really reflecting on this. Ultimately, I said, "Okay, I'll do it. Let's try it for 30 days. Let's see how it goes." 30 days later, like, his life has changed. His business has changed. My life has changed. Super impactful work. And that was my answer. And I said, "You know what? I don't need to be an operator. That doesn't have to be my identity. Just because that's what I've done doesn't mean that's what I have to do forever, right? And could I do it again in the future? Sure, but not right now, because fulfillment to me is this." So I really doubled down on that. I now am coaching five CEOs full time. I'm an advisor to around 10 companies, a couple of venture capital funds, doing some early stage investing, and have the podcast. And I do CEO dinners all over North America. And, like, this is fun. This is what I enjoy. And this is the ultimate sense of fulfillment for me.
First of all, paying attention to what people around you are saying about you. this person was looking to you and very persistent, saying, "You're the person for me. You're the person for me." We need to listen to that feedback. I agree. On the one hand, we need to listen to ourselves and what we want and what's good for us. But I also think there's a lot of value listening to what people who know you and trust you are saying and the value you could possibly give them. Also, a major amazing soundbite that you said that I love. I want to write it down and put it on a frame and put it next to my desk or something, is just because that's what you've done doesn't mean you have to do it forever. And you can always go back to it. And I feel like that is so important because so many of us are in this one track frame of mind. Well, this is what I've been doing. This is what I've experienced in. These are the kind of companies I worked for. How could I just do something else? Like, it's so hard for us to imagine a different reality when we're so used to it. So many things. So now you're coaching, you're advising, like you said, you're also working with individual founders, you're working with companies. A big topic you address, talk about, have approaches for is balance. And when I think of a startup founder, and I've worked with many startup founders, is there's no such thing. Like, it is not possible. I feel like with founders, your work is your life and it's who you are. We know that there is a mental health crisis amongst founders, especially underestimated founders or founders of color. I mean, it just feels like it's something impossible to attain. So please, I would love to hear your thoughts about how people, founders, can find this balance. How do we make it happen?
Yeah, I'll try to distill this down simply, as simply as I can.
I
There's this
put a lot of
miscon there's
pressure.
this no, it's there's this misconception that I think is starting to be dispelled a bit, which makes me very happy. But it's that if you're the founder of a company and the CEO, you have to eat, breathe, sleep your company. And I think the moment that you realize that your company is actually not that important in the grand scheme of things, and you like prioritize things in your life that are exponentially more important, like your relationships, like your health, like your passions and hobbies, that those are the things that actually will allow you to build the best company. Because if you do them right, it will put you in the frame of mind to be able to be the best CEO and the best leader for your people and for your business. And so, like, it's totally backwards today. Most believe, like, no, when you have extra time, you can think about those things. What I found is, though, like, a CEO can only be so productive in a day, right? So if you're an investor in a company and you believe your CEO should be working 14 hours a day, I promise they're not being productive 14 hours a day. They're being productive for like six, really, right? And if you open up the rest of their day to do things that bring them joy and bring them fulfillment and make them happy and allow them to take care of their health, they're going to be way better, right? And so this is like just a very simple realization that once CEOs realize it and they start to do it, it will change everything. It will change their life, their relationships, their physical and mental health, and ultimately their company and its performance.
I agree with this, and I want this to be the reality. And I love how you said you need, like, you talked about telling a CEO that their company isn't that important. And it's people who are taking risks, and this is their baby, and they're probably putting a lot of money, and there's a lot of skin in the game. So it is such a radical mindset shift. Again, I am so with you. I want the balance for all of these amazing entrepreneurs and all of the, in general, I want the balance when it comes to work, whether you're a founder and whatever, or whether you're working a 9-to-5 job and it doesn't, you're a cog in the system. I don't care. Like, I agree with the importance of The balance, I'm always trying to tease out the role that work plays in our lives and should it define us? Are we our work and all the things? What are like the first steps to try and change that mindset?
I'll say something, a very bold statement, which is the difference between a company succeeding and failing is how much energy the founder can consistently maintain day after day after day. Okay. And there's a couple of ways to do this. One of them is you have to find balance in your personal life. Okay. So, like when you're balanced at home, you're going to be energized at work. So this is like the first foundational piece of this. And there's several ways to sort of find that balance at home and several ways to prioritize these sort of things and do them. The next piece of that is you have to carry that energy into the workday and throughout the workday. There's a very simple framework to do this, which is called the zone of genius. You should be operating in your zone of genius. And the idea behind the zone of genius is when you do things that you're great at and that you love to do, this is called your zone of genius. It creates energy. Okay, so I want everybody that's listening to this, think about one thing you're great at that you love to do. And think in your brain, does that thing bring me energy? 100% of you, the answer is yes. I know this definitively. Anything else you do outside of that zone is an energy detractor. Okay. And so, specifically, CEOs, we have this complex, which is I have to do everything. I have to be capable of doing everything. If somebody on my team doesn't want to do it or isn't doing it, I'm just going to go do it. The problem is when you have that mindset, you're operating outside of your zone of genius most of the time. And so, most of what you're doing day to day is draining your energy. And then when you can realize that, hey, I'm only going to focus on predominantly things that bring me energy, things in my zone of genius, everything will change. This is the difference in a company being successful or failing. Because when the CEO's energized, they'll never have burnout. They'll have better relationships. They'll be more positive. They'll be able to speak their vision. They'll be able to be more authentic with their team, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down to performance will be higher. And that's it. And so maintaining balance in your life and focusing on doing things in your zone of genius, this is like the one sort of foundational key to success.
I love it. And I love that it really comes down to those two different things. Also, what you're good at and also what you really like, because they're not always the same. And that's really important. So it's important to find that sweet spot, you know, because some people on this show, we've asked people, or it's come up, or I think about it, you know, like, what am I passionate about? Like, what should I do that I'm good at? But just because you're good at it doesn't necessarily mean you enjoy it. So I agree how important it is. You gotta have the double whammy. I am stressed because there's so much more I want to cover with you, but we're not. But I will just a few final quickies. Again, like you are offering such interesting, amazing services with the energy audit. You have a founder's framework. You have this new podcast, The Roller Coaster. Ugh, why do I keep saying roller coaster? I don't know what's going on. I don't know what this is. Roller
Let's rebrand
coaster.
it. Let's
A
do
new
it.
one. Yeah, it's a new one. I'm creating another podcast called The Roller Coaster. I don't know. Is it like Kohler Toilets? Is that the brand? Should I? Okay, never mind. I'm gonna stop where I am and I'm not exploring this any further. And I want to talk to you about so much stuff about the quiet quitting, about the big tech layoffs right now, but you recently launched your podcast, the Roller Coaster Podcast. There, I did it. I said it nicely. Do you want to just share a
Yes.
bit about it, please, and your big hopes for the podcast?
Yeah, I'd love to. The roller coaster, which is how it's pronounced, podcast,
Oh.
is a podcast that's designed for current or aspiring entrepreneurs to understand what's truly required in the pursuit of building a great company. And the reason it's called a roller coaster is I think if there's one word to describe what doing a startup is, it's that, right? It's topsy-turvy, it's highs and lows every day, extreme highs, extreme lows, depression, anxiety, wins, success, all within the same day. And it's incredibly difficult to navigate when that's happening day after day after day. And so on the podcast, and hopefully you got a sense of my style today, my role as the interviewer, the moderator, is to pull out these like really raw and deep stresses and pressures and anxieties and depression and other stuff that CEOs feel while they're navigating the roller coaster of their startup. And so far it's been amazing. We've dropped four episodes. I've got several really heavy hitters in the queue. Most of these are founders, by the way, who have started a company and exited. And some that are coming up, just to tease the audience, exited for north of a billion. And so it's fun. It's going to be really fun to talk about how they started at zero and got to where they got to. So.
Well, cue me up for 2025, when I'm your guest. Ha. When it maybe one
Can't
day.
wait.
Who knows? Who knows? I will give links in the show notes to the Roller Coaster podcast and where people can follow you. Tyler, what words of
Thank
wisdom would you give to someone who doesn't know what to do with their lives and is trying to figure it out?
I would say sit down and write down exactly what a perfect day would look like for you, including your career, including your personal interests, exactly what you do every hour in your perfect day. And then write down exactly what you're doing in a normal day. And then figure out what's the bridge to get from what I do on average on a normal day to getting to this perfect ideal day. And if you do that and you focus on making small incremental changes, eventually you'll get to a place where you're doing your perfect day. And that's how I think you achieve balance and fulfillment and like pure joy and happiness in your life.
I love that. Such a good exercise that all of us can do. And to be honest, I never heard that. I never heard of doing what is the perfect day. You know, I in a holistic way, what is the perfect day, including really everything. So I'm excited to try that myself. Where can people follow you, stay up to date with what you're doing, stay on your radar, work with
Yeah, I
you?
spend sure. I spend most of my time on LinkedIn. I'm getting up to paces on the other social media platforms, but LinkedIn, we'll include a link to that on here. Typically, you're going to see everything there. My updates, what's going on in my life. I think you'll find some valuable, content around being an entrepreneur and a CEO of a company. The podcast is there, the newsletter's there. Everything's there, so drop in. I'd love to communicate with you.
Amazing. This was so awesome. And I feel really revved up and energized from this conversation and you and your honesty and your, there's a really good Yiddish word, chutzpah. You know the word chutzpah? It's like audacity. And that's just, I feel like that's you, but I just love your honesty and realness. Like earlier, I don't know if you remember, but 20 minutes ago, you said that you were a horrible CEO at one point. Like you really just told us the
It's the
things, and
worst.
you're
That
just
was the worst.
super okay, you know, and that's like a whole other episode, right? But like just your honesty and realness, and I'm sure again, one day you'll have me on your show, one day you'll be my coach, and I just can't wait to keep learning from you. Thank you
Thanks,
so
Steph.
much. This was so awesome. Zoom, 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 it's my boom, boom. Hey everyone, I hope you enjoyed the talk with Tyler. A lot stuck out to me from our conversation. I think one of my favorite things he said is when it came to making a change in his career, he had to make the mental shift of just because that's what I've done doesn't mean that's what I have to do forever. I could do it again in the future, but I'm not going to do it right now. This attitude is so important for all of us to adapt. I feel like adapt, adopt. I feel like too often we don't take the chance to go for a new job, to change career paths, whatever, because we feel married to what we've been doing until now. We need to let go of this belief because it's limiting us of what we can do and stopping us from where we ultimately want to go. I also loved when Tyler shared that the best thing he learned to do in his life was to stop caring what other people think. Especially when it comes to making decisions about our lives and our careers, it's just the easiest thing for the opinions and comments from others to stop us from making the best moves for ourselves. It's not easy, it doesn't happen overnight, but I agree, we all need to work on this so we can do what's best for us, do what we need to do, and be in the most authentic alignment with ourselves and what we're meant to be doing. You can learn more about Tyler, his unique services and offerings for CEOs on his website, www.tylerchristianhall.com. You can connect with Tyler on LinkedIn and make sure to check out the great content he shares. And of course, you can listen to the Roller Coaster podcast on Apple or Spotify. Links are in the show notes, so check them out. Bye.